Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And we are here today. We have we're going to do an episode discussion. And this was actually based off of one of our conversations we had when we, was this when we were talking about our top 25 episodes, Jen?
I do believe it was.
Probably, because this episode, Never Again, season 4, is one of my very, very, very favorite episodes, and Jen is not having it. And so I thought that would be a really interesting discussion to have.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe you issued me a challenge.
I did. And you met that challenge and you passed that challenge with flying colors. I'm so proud of you.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, here we are talking about it. Not only did I watch the episode a couple of times, we're going to talk about it. We're going to hash this out. I'm going to explore all my feelings for Never Again now.
I'm so excited.
All right, good. Well, we'll see how you feel once we get talking.
Oh, no. I am ready. So, all right. Season 4, episode 13, Never Again. And before we start talking about this, because I do want to get your initial thoughts on what you think and what you used to think and what you think now and if it's changed and if it hasn't. We should mention the fact that Never Again was originally, or was it written to air before Leonard Betts? Or yeah, it was slotted there.
I believe it was my understanding, and I did a little bit of reading on this today, as a matter of fact.
Good.
From what I could determine, that it was written and filmed before the cancer arc was even conceived, because the cancer arc was conceived very last minute, right?
Yeah.
That was not something that was like planned at the start of season 4. That was something that they kind of planned very much on the fly. And so, from what I understand, they had actually completed the filming of Never Again before they even considered the cancer arc as even a storyline. So
yeah,
it obviously was not meant to be part of that.
It looks like on Wikipedia, some of these episodes that like came after the cancer arc, with like Caddish, I think they're numbered before Leonard Betts.
That's right.
So so that makes sense to me. And I think it's a very interesting conversation, and it's a conversation worth having just because this is all happening at the same time, of her motivations in this episode, Scully's motivations during this episode, whether she knows about her diagnosis and whether she doesn't. Mm-hmm. Always approach it, my personal preference is to approach it that she doesn't, because I like the idea that this is completely unrelated to the cancer arc and it is just a natural progression of where she's at. What would be your thoughts?
I agree with you. I feel I'm kind of two minds, mostly because my general mantra and rule of thumb is follow what's on the screen. And if it's something's on the screen in a certain way, then that's what it is as far as canon is concerned. But in this case, it's tricky because that was not canon at the time that this story was written and filmed. If it had been written one way and then filmed with the idea that it would be part of the cancer arc, I could live with that. But the fact that they'd actually filmed it before that, and so that informed everybody's performance, particularly Gillian Anderson.
Right.
There's no way, I don't think, you can legitimately consider that as part of the cancer story when the actress did not intend for that to be her performance.
Well, it's
and
funny, though.
And so
You can say that, and I think it's we all like to just kind of fan wink it the way we want to, which is in the end what we all do anyway, because I mean you can make the same argument for My Struggle 4, like Scully didn't know she was pregnant when we're watching this
right.
scene where we all think she knows she's pregnant, you know, and it doesn't change the fact that that's what's on the screen, that the character knows that she's pregnant, but Gillian didn't know.
True.
So I mean it from the intent of the creator, you could think that, yeah, this is why. But I really doubt that that was intended. And it's kind of unfortunate that this is such a huge controversy. Because I think it kind of colors the whole episode, if you think about it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. I mean, it makes a big difference. It makes this is a case where changing, because it's certainly not unusual to change the airing order of the episodes, right? That happens in every season.
Right.
But this is, to me, the most egregious example of a change in a storyline because of the order in which it was aired.
Correct.
And I don't really understand personally exactly who made that decision in the end.
Well, the network did.
Would Chris Carter have had any input on that, do you think?
I think so, but I think he would have made the decision, and I think he made the right decision, that Leonard Betts was a better episode to show after the Super Bowl.
Right. I think it came down to that, right?
And like, absolutely, that's absolutely what it came down to, was a, hey, which one is a better one to get people hooked? And he made the right choice. Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, that seems to be like that was a 11th hour decision that until they had made that decision or had that discussion. I mean, I'm sure that Leonard Betts was set to air after Never Again. So
definitely. It's
interesting.
That's tied in as well with... I'm not sure if everyone knows already that, and I'm sure you and I do, that Quentin Tarantino was originally slated and hoped and expected to direct this.
Right.
And I think, I mean, I don't think that was like a pie in the sky idea. I think they got pretty far along. I think he had almost agreed to do it, but there was a last minute sort of glitch with like he wasn't a member of the Directors Guild or something like that.
Yeah, it was like some sort of strange conflict. Like he wanted to do it. Mm. And I think that if there's one episode that I think he would have knocked out of the park, it's this one.
Mm-hmm.
I think
it was meant for him.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, you know me, I love it. Personally, I think it's perfect as it is. So I don't feel like we missed anything by not getting him.
Yeah. So I think that was the original concept, was that Quentin Tarantino would be the director, and that was what would make it a Super Bowl worthy episode, because they'd have this very sort of, you know, high end, high profile director, and that would make it into an event.
Did you read that, or are you speculating? Because I really, really doubt.
I can't remember.
They would have had any clue that this was going to be airing during the Super Bowl like a year before. When they're still writing and conceiving of this episode? No.
Oh.
No.
No, I just mean like when they're during the filming. Oh no, sorry. When they're
making the decision
of making the decision about who the director was going to be. I think that they had the thought that would go roughly in that slot. Okay. That's my understanding. But okay. I could be wrong about that.
I have no idea. That seems kind of like too far away for them to have known that. But anyway, we should give credit to Rob Bowman, who did end up directing the episode.
He did, and did a dandy job.
Well, tell me, Jen, I want to know just your right off the top first impressions, because I know you said you haven't watched this, and you said like 15 years. And
I think that was probably, it's probably been longer than that, reality wise.
Yeah, yeah, and you didn't like it then. So tell me what you liked about it or didn't like about it now.
I like it better than I used to. I feel like I can watch it now. I mean, I skipped it every time it would come around and I would see it on the list. I'd be like, nope, not an episode.
That's so
and
funny.
Go on to the next one. But having watched a couple of times this week, I feel like I've kind of like built up some immunity to that now, and I can handle it. And I recognize there's some good points about it that make it worth watching. Some great points about it in some cases. There's still some things I don't like about it particularly. It's not gonna make a list of favorites of mine. It's never gonna be something I love, I don't think. But I get that it's a good episode now. I get why people like it. And there are some parts about it that I like quite a bit, actually.
Well, let's talk about something that what's your favorite thing about it, and we'll just go from there. What was your biggest takeaway?
My favorite thing about this, and it's really quite, it's better done and more uniquely done on this episode than perhaps any other X-Files episode, and that is the way it illustrates a conflict between Mulder and Scully, which we rarely see in any kind of depth. Mm-hmm. And so the first and last scenes between Mulder and Scully are what make this whole episode worth watching now for me. The first scene in the office when mm-hmm. Mulder is giving Scully her quote unquote assignment. Mm-hmm. And then the last scene at the very end of the episode, those are such well-written, scenes. And it's, Glenn Morgan and James Wong are the writers on this, and they always do a beautiful job with writing. They do a great job with writing Scully in particular. Mm-hmm. So no surprise that they did a dandy job with this. And so the writing's really strong. The acting's really strong. I love those scenes because usually when we see Mulder and Scully, they're like totally in sync, on board. Mulder's doing some crazy shit, but Scully doesn't mind, and everything is fine. Everything's fine between them. Everything's crashing down around them, but everything's always fine between Mulder and Scully.
I don't necessarily agree with that assessment, but go ahead.
Okay, like under it all, they might have like disagreements. But yeah. You feel like their relationship is strong, that the
right.
foundation this, and bedrock of their relationship is always there.
Right. This is the first time it feels very raw, like they're not really talking about it. They're not saying words about it. It's just all subtext, you know?
It is almost all subtext. There's some little hints. It's very much a snippy kind of conversation. It right. feels really, it's well written in the sense that it feels really real to me.
Yes.
Like this is how
real people talk or have issues.
This is how real people talk. Yeah. This is how couples argue a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
They don't sort of lay out, this is exactly what I'm unhappy about. And the other person doesn't necessarily directly address that. They sort
Correct.
Of talk around it. They have like beefs that they've brought to the table that they aren't exactly expressing. They're picking up on the wrong issue from their partner and going off on tangents that aren't really what the real subject at hand is. And they're just kind of, there's a simmering sort of annoyance and anger and resentment underneath the conversation that never quite gets resolved, but still sort of finds a way of emerging in different ways that are really not particularly useful. And there's attempts in the course of those conversations to pretend that everything's fine, that this is a normal conversation. Let's get back on track. And it doesn't quite work because neither of them are in that headspace.
Yeah. It's kind of like exactly what you said about them just not being in sync. I think that's like the best way to describe it. And it's kind of heartbreaking. I mean, even though the next episode, everything's fine again.
Yeah.
But that's just the way they operate. And I think it's kind of detrimental to their relationship, I think, as we see as the years go by, because I think a lot of the time that's what they do, is they keep things in and they don't talk about it, and then it just bursts at some point. And I think maybe a lot of people do that. That's kind of and that's where the realism of this couple comes in, like these two people, even though they're not a couple, you know what I mean, they're a couple of people, that's their partnership, that's where that comes in here. And I think that's I think you're right, I agree with you, that's one of my favorite things about this episode. But I'm curious, in terms of you as such a Scully fan, I think that this episode has so much insight into Scully that we probably haven't seen up to this point, that I'm surprised that you're not a fan of some of those scenes in the middle of this episode.
I know.
Are you still bumping up against her with another guy? Is that still your problem?
That's mostly my problem, I think, still. I don't know. It's just, I have trouble with her with another guy. Although I get it. It's fine. I'm not like objecting to it. And I mean, he is hot. I've forgotten how hot Ed Jurce is.
Yeah.
He's a hottie.
Yeah.
I guess it's just, I think if I'm being honest with myself, there are certain aspects of Scully's character that I like better than others.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the aspects that we tend to see most often. The Scully who displays poor judgment is not a Scully we see very often, and I think it's not my favorite version of Scully, even though it's real. I mean, we're all imperfect human beings, and it makes her a more real character and a well-rounded character. But it's just kind of like, I feel like I'm watching it a little bit with like my fingers over my eyes saying, girlfriend, don't do this. It's not really smart.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I wouldn't go back. I would say that I like it because it's in character for Scully, and it's in character for this episode, the way she's being treated. I mean, this seems to me like a very proportionate response to how she's feeling. So I can't watch it and think that she's doing anything stupid or doing anything. I mean, I think she is reacting to how she feels in a very, very realistic way. So I don't look at it and think, it's not like when I watch a horror movie and I'm like, don't go up those stairs, dummy. That like, it's not like that. Like, because like, there's, first of all, there's no way she could possibly know that he's a psycho. Like, I mean, although that creepy apartment, I would have said, run, Dana, run. But I can't get mad about that, because like every single apartment on the X-Files looks like that. So it's like that. I think that's just how apartments look on the X-Files, you know? So other than that, and I mean, he's got issues, but so does she. So I kind of am like, and she doesn't probably expect for it to go where it ultimately goes or doesn't go, depending on what you think. probably isn't expecting that, isn't expecting anything. And she's behaving very impulsively, which we don't see. And I find that really interesting and really special. And the fact that she is reacting to Mulder makes it all the more interesting, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, I think that this is, as a study of Scully's character, it's probably one of the best episodes we get in terms of learning more about her as a individual and as a person. I'm just not crazy about some of the things we learned about her. I tend to think that there were warning signs about Ed Durst that she was ignoring. That would, to me, I would have said, girl, no, don't even with
but
him
she
right
was,
now.
But she knew that. Like, and she it, like she was probably, she was like, this bad boy. I shouldn't be doing any of this, which is exactly why I'm doing it. And that's the whole point. Like, I love the conversation that she has with him in the bar about her father and about how she would smoke the cigarettes because she didn't want him to catch her, but she secretly hoped that he would catch her. And I relate that so much to Mulder, like to her doing this because she wants him to find out. She she wants to be not taken for granted. She wants to be accepted, not accepted, that's not the right word, but she wants to be acknowledged. And I don't even mean in like a romantic way. I just mean like in a life way. Like, she's already feeling unworthy. There's the whole conversation about the desk and she's just like, what is going on? Like, what is my life? Like, so I just think it's perfect. I don't want to say midlife crisis because she's not at midlife, but it seems like, hey, you know, Scully gone wild. I don't know. I love it.
It is.
I love it.
It is. It's definitely Scully gone wild is exactly what this episode is. And it is very much in character for her. We don't see that aspect of her character very often, but we see it often enough that it's certainly believable. You can, you know, you can look back to season one with Beyond the Sea to see some indications of this kind of rebellious nature. Yeah. Even back to the pilot, you know, she talks about going into the FBI against her parents' wishes. So the idea of Scully as a rebel, if anything, is probably an under-fleshed out aspect of her character that was probably... It was a bit overdue, maybe, in terms of having a bit of an episode that explored that a little bit more.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely she's really self-aware. I mean, we rarely get Scully or Mulder so aware of what their own motivations are and actually articulating it. Because they almost never articulate it to each other. So the fact that she gets a chance to interact with another character, which we don't often see, right?
No.
With Scully especially.
Unloading to him more than she ever does to Mulder.
Yeah, and so we get real insights into what she thinks about her behavior, which sound very sort of accurate. She's very aware of exactly what she's doing in terms of rebellion and father figures in her life and controlling figures and how part of her likes that and seeks that. Mm-hmm. And part of her is just like, okay, I can only take so much of it, though.
Yeah.
It's a very complex aspect to her character. I mean, a lot of us have, as normal human beings, we have kind of contradictory natures in some ways. And the fact that she recognizes that she has this inherent contradiction of seeking approval, but while also wanting to rebel, it's difficult to understand that about yourself, let alone articulate it. So that's really well done.
That's in line with Scully in general. I mean, she has her whole faith crisis with the faith and the science. And I feel like that's what makes her character so interesting. It's like Mulder is just so straightforward.
Yes.
He's such... I mean, and I love Mulder to death, but like when you look at the complexity of these two characters, he's such a more simple character, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree.
And Scully's got a lot more complexity going on, which I think you need that character to have that, because if she doesn't have that, she becomes the boring one.
Yeah, you're right.
So I think that that's smart, and I like the way they did that. But I really like getting that extra insight into her. And I mean, the only way we're going to get that insight is a scene like this.
Yes.
When I say like this, the scenes with Ed is what I'm referring to. But so I mean, to get that insight, and you know, I think it's worth it. What do you think about the whole conversation about the desk? I was going to ask you about this because this comes up a lot.
It does.
A lot. What do you think about that?
I have said before, and I stand by it, that I don't think Scully wants a desk. Mm-mm. I know that a lot of people think she does, And,
no, it's not, you know, about the desk.
I don't think she never even expresses a desire to have one.
No.
All she ever says is, why don't I have one?
Exactly.
She never says, I'd like to have a desk. She's trying to start a conversation.
Right. And he doesn't get it because he's
being way too literal throughout really both conversations at the beginning and end of the episode between Mulder and Scully. Mulder's being way too literal and way too just like surface meaning, which is a not uncommon characteristic of men in conversations with women.
Yes.
Not all men, of course.
Not all men.
But a lot of men have this issue, and it's really very much on display in that conversation.
Yeah.
And so he hears desk, and so did many viewers, and we all kind of thought, yes, Scully deserves a desk. And, you know, campaigns arose to get Scully a desk.
I mean, and I really do think that the desk argument, when I say the desk argument, the one that I see online constantly, I do think it's a bit tongue in cheek. I mean, I think that they don't actually think that she should have a physical wooden desk. I think it's more about, I don't know. That's the problem. I don't really know. If that's what people think, then more power to them. I think that that's ridiculous.
We'll find out.
We will. People will respond to this. But I think that the people who are saying that are probably more about the concept, the idea of the respect, the idea of the equal treatment. And she brings that up, like, why it sounds like you're my superior. You know, and she's, you know, that's the stuff that's important. And I mean, he doesn't seem to say, he never once says, I am your superior, or I don't think you can handle this. He never once says that. But at the same time, he's not giving her what she wants to hear.
No. Well, I mean, everything he does just fuels the fire of her annoyance and irritation. I mean, they're at such cross purposes, which is how things go in bad conversations between people, because Mulder's coming, I think he's coming into this conversation already annoyed at Scully because she quote unquote abandoned him during questioning.
Yeah.
At like 2:30 in the morning. I don't think I realized until this week that very opening scene where Mulder is meeting up with, you know, sort of a Russian informant, that the timestamp on that is like 2:30 in the morning.
And she's just like, why am I even here? This is ridiculous.
She was so over it. And can you blame her? And she, presents a pretty good argument for why she was. So Mulder's like super annoyed that heavens for Fenn that Scully would like walk 10 feet away during a questioning of an informant when, like, I mean, how many times has Mulder abandoned Scully in a much more substantive way than that?
I know. So he's already frustrating.
He's got a beef about that already. He senses that she is disinterested, and maybe he's worried that she's disinterested, you know, anger and fear often very commingled. And so maybe he's worried that there's something up, that maybe he's going to lose her, that she's lost interest in the X-Files. And so he's already going into that conversation with that on his mind. And at the same time, Scully's going to that conversation with a totally different issue on her mind, which is, what is my role here? What is my role in the X-Files? She's going in, she's in, like you say, it's not quite a midlife crisis. It's like, what is it that Scully calls it in Weremonster? A questioning phase.
Yes.
When she's talking about Mulder.
Yeah.
She's in a questioning phase.
Yeah.
And she's discontented with where she is exactly.
Right.
And why not, really? I mean, when you look at where Scully is and where her life is and what it is in relation to Mulder, it's totally understandable that she might have some concerns about that.
Right.
And she just wants to sort of express that and to talk about that and to sort of get some support from Mulder and maybe to kind of get some reassurance that it's worth it, that what she's doing makes sense, that her having devoted herself to the X-Files is for a reason, because she has a partnership here, that what she has put into the X-Files, she's getting something out of it. And even if that something is just the mutual respect of her partner as being on his level.
Well, and in the end, it all comes down to like that scene in Fight the Future that you love so much, when they are talking and he finally is able to give that validation to her.
Absolutely.
And I mean, that's not much further than this, but it's still a whole season and a half away. But I do think that you're right what you're saying about in terms of Scully. Like she even, I think, inadvertently kind of I don't want to say like denigrates the X-Files, but kind of makes a comment. I don't remember. She says something about like, well, and it's become mine. It's become my life too. Like it, kind of implying that that's not what she wants.
Yeah.
And he, of course, is going to take that personally, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah, because it to him, that implies that she doesn't want him.
Correct.
I mean, Mulder and the X-Files are one and the same.
Right. And I think he gets very defensive.
He is very defensive. Absolutely. And I think that he's just in that headspace going into that conversation that she's unhappy and she's letting him down to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And she's going into it with a totally different headspace. And so they're just going into it with their own kind of agenda, not like, you know, not like a, I don't mean that in a negative sense, but they have their own concerns.
Right.
And I think Scully makes something of a good faith effort to try to air those feelings,
mm-hmm.
More so than Mulder does, because like there's at one point sort of late in the conversation, she sounds like she's trying to be quite sort of upfront with him in a roundabout way. When she says something like, I feel like I've lost sight of myself, Mulder. That
yeah.
sounds to me like she's really spilling her guts at that moment.
She was trying to see if he's going to bite and he doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. She's trying to be like pretty upfront. Like up until that point in the conversation, she is being a little roundabout with the whole kind of coy about the desk and stuff. But as the conversation goes on, she becomes more and more upfront.
Yeah.
About exactly what her concerns are. But like she's lost Mulder somewhere along the way. He doesn't want to hear it. I mean, when she starts to really get down to that issue and really wants to kind of, you know, it's a pretty important, obviously it's a really significant issue and a really could have been a very significant conversation. And she was kind of at that point of being ready to talk about it in that moment. But the very next thing that Mulder says after she talks about, you know, where she thinks she is in her life and her frustrations with that, is all he has to say to that is, well, maybe it's good that we get away from each other for a while. Well, not helpful, Mulder. That's not the right way to respond to that.
That's yeah. I mean, but that's what he does is he
yes.
runs away. And I mean,
yep.
And I think that they are both culpable of that. Obviously, that bears out later down the road when Scully leaves him. But I mean, Mulder's always leaving her.
Always.
Always
yeah.
running. And I mean, they both run away from these sorts of conversations all the time. So it's not, it's not like, this isn't like out of the ordinary. It's just, I think the way that they're talking is different. And I feel like he is behaving like kind of like a child. And it's annoying to see like Mulder that way, even though I know that like that's, I can look at that and be like, well, that's Mulder. Like but he's not normally such a dick about it. But like I can watch it and be like, well, this isn't like out of character dickishness. This just seems like this is Mulder on a bad day. You know,
it is exactly right.
Yeah.
And like I say, I think he's just annoyed that he came into it already annoyed about how Scully had behaved the night before, even though, you know,
right.
to me, it seems not unreasonable behavior on her part. But in his mind, he's aggrieved already.
Yes.
And so he's already kind of in a bad. And
yeah.
so is she. And he's also in a bad mood because he has to take this vacation and he doesn't want to leave his baby X-Files
right.
behind.
Right, right, right.
So,
he's
yeah,
doubly
you're right.
in a bad mood.
It's just, yeah, they're just kind of both in a bad mood for different reasons.
Yeah.
And that those bad moods clash.
Yeah.
And it's very real to me, but really uncomfortable because it's something that we see so rarely between them. The other episode that it makes me think of in sort of a more comedic way, obviously, is I want to say Syzygy, the one with the planets are under
yeah.
alignment.
Yeah.
And so they're both kind of like at each other's throats for the whole episode, but that's kind of played like for laughs. And,
right, and they're
case,
both
they,
kind of being externally motivated.
Exactly. There's like an explanation.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything is fixed at the end.
Yeah.
But in this case, and never again, everything is not fixed at the end. Everything is so not fixed at the end.
Right. Ugh.
I feel like the end of this episode, if I can jump ahead to the end for a second.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I wrote this down. I think it's the saddest ending of an X-Files episode ever for me. And I mean, we have a lot of sad endings for X-Files episodes. But for me, the way it makes me feel when I watch this is so sad because.
Yeah. But it's so angsty. But you should love
it. It's
that.
Angsty. Well, I like the angst, but I like it when it's like, but when Mulder and Scully are experiencing the angst together.
I see what
in
you're
the
saying.
Same way. And the angst is kind of like an external angst.
I see what you're saying.
angst between them upsets me.
Yeah.
It's like mom and dad are fighting.
I know. I get it. And I guess I just like it because anytime, I'm a huge fan of anytime they have any sort of interaction that progresses their relationship. And I think that this did. I mean, you can look at it as a negative way, but I don't look at it as a negative way. I feel like, hey, we had this fight or this thing where we have to actually acknowledge the fact that the personal is intermingling with the professional. And that's just kind of the way this is and the way this is going to be. So I appreciate it for that reason. What did you think about the rose petal? What do you think that that symbolized?
I mean, I'm guessing it's meant to represent like the transience of life or life passing or time passing, the sense that life is passing by. And
why give it to Mulder? Like, why leave it on his desk? Like, what do you think? What do you make of all of that?
Good question.
Because I still kind of don't have a working theory about what I feel about that rose petal. Like, I don't really know.
I'm struggling a little bit with the rose petal, too. It's one of those things that I feel like it's meant to mean something.
Yeah.
But I haven't quite got a handle on it. I understand kind of what it means to Scully in the sense that to her, it's something that's something concrete that she's looking to that's kind of evoking these feelings that represent her feelings.
Right.
Of this is my life is slowly withering away. And I'm not quite, but the part that I'm having a trouble sort of coming up with a consistent theory that makes sense is how that works in relationship with Mulder.
Right. Like why does she put it on his desk? Why is it still there? Why does she pick it up? Like, obviously it all needs to mean something. It makes me think of like the quarter necklace that the mom wore.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of the whisper in the church. I mean, all these beautiful things that are like, these are the things that we're never going to know. So yeah. I kind of look at it like that, and then I can think, you know what, this means something to her.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have to be spelled out to me, and that's how I feel about a lot of these episodes. So I just was curious if you had anything to say about it, and you pretty much have exactly the same thing to say about it. Is it like, I don't really know. I'm not really sure.
I feel like it means something, but I just don't know what that is.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think you're right that to a certain extent, whenever we're watching The X-Files, there's always going to be points at which things aren't clearly explained.
Right.
Those things are plot-wise or relationship-wise or symbolism-wise. And we all have to kind of be zen about that.
Yeah.
And so this is one of those things that it doesn't totally make sense, but that it doesn't mean that it's done badly by any means.
No.
It's interesting and intriguing in the way that, you know, like I always think like the best poetry doesn't totally make sense, but you know it's really great anyway.
Well, and it's got us talking, so.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's just something that looks interesting and just it seems to mean something to the characters and maybe we don't totally get it. It's not necessarily, you know, an ABC kind of thing.
Yeah.
You can't connect the dots all the time. The X-Files is not a connect the dots kind of a show.
Right, right.
But it's intriguing. Mm-hmm. It's intriguing. It's an interesting symbol.
What do you think about, while we're talking about symbols, what do you think about the tattoo? What do you think it means? Why do you think she did it? Do you have anything to say about the actual tattoo?
Yeah, I mean, the tattoo is sort of, it's central to the episode for sure.
Right.
A tattoo is kind of, on one level, it's very representative of rebellion. I mean, it's like the fastest and easiest way to rebel against society
anything.
Or your parents or anything is to get a tattoo. And so this idea that, this guy has a tattoo and he seems to represent some kind of rebellious nature that she admires and wants to emulate to some extent. And it's like, and he kind of dares her to do it kind of thing. And she's like, well, this is not the kind of thing I would normally do, but I'm going to do it just for that reason.
Mm.
And so it's a quick and easy way to say, hey, look at me. I'm rebelling.
I have a theory, too.
Okay, what's your theory?
It's a bit of a deep theory.
Oh, good.
But I have this headcanon that Scully kind of likes a little bit of pain.
Well, she's liking that tattoo, I have to say.
Yeah.
That whole tattoo scene.
I mean, okay, and we have some evidence to back this up.
Okay.
I would say the way that Ed kind of grabs her,
mm-hmm.
like twice.
Yep.
She likes that.
She clearly does. This
and
happens
then,
like this is like once in the bar and then once in his apartment afterwards.
Yeah.
He kind of, yeah, grabs her very aggressively.
She likes that. I think that is all wrapped up with the whole like, father figure thing and like the dominant. I really have a feeling that Scully likes that. And then, you know, of course, we find out later on, which also is gifted to us by Glenn Morgan, the idea that handcuffs come into play later down the road. And so I have this sort of headcanon in my mind that this is all related.
Yeah, you know what? You make a pretty strong case. I mean, there's definitely there's stuff there to back that up.
Yeah. Getting out of my sort of silly fan fiction head, I think that the I stand by it. I think it's true. But I don't I think that she you're totally right about the rebellion. I like the idea that she feels like this is an important moment in her life, and she takes his advice in terms of like, you know what, you're right, I'm gonna just do this because I want to remember this mm-hmm. moment. It kind of makes me just think of Lost Art of Forehead Sweat when she says, I want to remember how it all was.
I wish I was watching that episode right now instead. That's okay. Now, what about the actual tattoo itself? I still haven't quite got my head around exactly the significance of, I can't remember what the name of that symbol is that she gets with the snake eating its tail.
It's the Ouroboros. And I think she, I mean, to me, it's that thing about two steps forward and three steps back,
right.
Whatever she says. It's just, it's this never ending line. And to me, yeah. I mean, I look at that and It, whatever you think what happened with the tattoo, is it there, is it gone, whatever, I don't know if she got rid of it, Chris Carter says she got rid of it, whatever, who cares. I think it symbolizes this idea to me of like the endless search for the truth.
Yeah.
And okay. They never say that, it's just my interpretation, but it always makes me think of like how she feels working on the X-Files and how Mulder never seems to feel. But how she feels, because she's always the one that's like, I want to stop.
Yeah,
and he's always the one who says, no, we can't. We have to keep going. We can't stop. And so that's to me what that kind of represents is just this sort of endless circle that just never ends.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really great way of putting it, because there's some imagery throughout the episode in terms of lines versus circles. You know, in the opening conversation with Mulder and Scully, of course, we have Scully talking about her life going in a line. It's not even a circle. And then in our conversation with Ed, he talks about how he's going in a line as well, and he only wants to go forward. And so that's definitely in keeping with sort of that's the theme of the episode, I think, is like, what direction is your life going in exactly?
Right. Right.
Which is a really worthwhile theme and worth exploring, and why I'm so kind of irked about this idea that let's just oversimplify it by pretending it's about the cancer, because it's written in a way that it means so much more than that. And it's so much more interesting.
Right.
Plus, I mean, those aspects.
Here's the thing, too, is like we see how Scully behaves when she finds out that she gets cancer.
Yeah.
And it's not this way.
No, you know? Exactly.
So,
it's so not.
I think that's the biggest proof, the biggest evidence that I can take, that I don't think that she's just going out and doing this because she found out she has cancer. Like, that doesn't seem like something Scully would do to me.
It doesn't fit. It doesn't fit. It doesn't fit with any of how she behaved.
Right.
When she had cancer. I mean, I'm interested in how the episode ends on a very uncertain note, really, with things very up in the air, really, between Mulder and Scully. I actually really like that ending, even though it's very sad and kind of like almost painful to watch. I think it's really interesting and really compelling and such a different kind of ending. I think we talked about this a little bit in our Top 25 episode about how I'm really intrigued by the fact that there's absolutely no music at the end of that episode.
Mm-mm.
That is completely silent. It really emphasizes the silence in the room, this uncomfortable silence.
Yeah.
And like they're looking in different directions. Scully's looking down, Mulder's looking up, and they're just kind of like at a loss.
And you don't see uncomfortable silence between them ever. Even when they're talking and they have things to say that never have to do with their own relationship, by the way. They don't have that. They don't have that sort of uncomfortable moment where they don't know what to say. Like that's not something that happens. So
I think it was really, really interesting the way that was done and the way that was left. And that's very reflective of kind of real relationships too. Sometimes you just kind of, you hit a bit of a dead end and you don't really know exactly where to go. Things don't always wrap themselves up.
Right.
And I'm always kind of intrigued by like, where did things go from there, to go from the end of that to the start of Memento Mori, where they're clearly, you know, on a much sort of more intimate level again. I wonder what episode would have come after Never Again if they hadn't played around with the production order. And would that next episode have made more sense given where this episode ended?
I'm going to say no, because they do this all the fucking time on this show.
Well, that's true.
So, no, this is exactly like I say. Either they talk about it off screen and we don't see it, or they don't talk about it at all and it festers. And I think it's more likely the second one, to be honest. Yeah. Because that's like, that's just the way these two operate. So,
well, and there's no evidence that that issue was ever resolved for Scully. That issue of what is her role in the X-Files, it's an ongoing issue for the whole rest of the series, really.
I mean, like I said, other than what he says to her in the hallway, which was a very big moment and a very big deal.
Was.
She got some validation there that she needed.
She did.
So, I mean, in a way that does get resolved, but then it turns into a kind of like another issue, a different kind of issue.
it's never ending. The question of like, where are we in our lives? Where are we going? You know, in Dreamland, it comes up, you know, do you ever feel like just getting out of the car?
Right. In all things, it comes up when she says something to him at the very beginning, and don't you want to stop or something like that? And he says, I don't know what I would be missing, and he just takes off like a dick.
That's right.
Yeah. So I mean, this is a theme that they go over and over. They're just not on the same page when it comes to this.
I think that leading into my
whole thing about the fact that these two were doomed to break up at some point.
Well, I mean, we see that there's obviously some fundamental flaws in their relationship here.
Right.
And there's no indication that they dealt with that.
Exactly.
And every indication that it just keeps coming up.
Yep.
Because it feels insurmountable in a way. It's like to them, it probably feels a bit like an unsolvable problem. And I mean, in the end, it took 11 seasons, but in the end, they were able to solve it to some extent.
Right. Well, and I think that's what happens a lot of the time. Sorry to interrupt, but I think that's what happens a lot of the time, is that people just don't know how to surmount them. So they just ignore it. So
it's just there's difficult issues in every relationship, and some of them feel too difficult to overcome. It feels easier to sort of set them aside instead, sweep them under the rug and say, this is fine. We can put up with this. And this is one of the few episodes where it kind of, you know, it comes out a little bit on the surface. Erupts. That's the word I'm looking for. It erupts a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right that probably we have every reason to believe that there was an eruption, and then they both probably were happy to pretend it had never happened.
Yeah, and they do that all the time. Let's talk about Mulder a little bit more. I wanted to talk about the idea that he can't wait to get away from her, but like can't go 20 minutes without calling her. You know, and like he knows where she's staying, he's just checking in, blah 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 blah. Like I think they have such a serious codependency issue. Like it's so obvious to me that it's like they have a problem, because they're so dependent on each other, but they don't talk. It's so clear to me. But like even the same thing is like, she doesn't want to go on the assignment, but she goes because of course she's gonna go, you know, like
I kind of see that as, I get your point, and I can definitely see that. That's definitely a valid interpretation. I see it more as that maybe they start off in a way, even though it doesn't work out, that they're trying to, that's their way of apologizing to one another in a way. Like once they are separated and they go their own way, they both kind of cool off. Whatever got them mad during the conversation has maybe sort of tapered off. And so, you know, Mulder wants to call Scully, and he's trying to think of an excuse to call her, basically. It's because he wants to talk to her and make sure that everything's okay.
Yeah.
He's not going to address the question. He's not going to apologize. He's just going to talk to her, and he just wants to feel better. He feels bad about how things were left, and that's causing him distress. And so he just wants to talk to her to just feel okay again. And he keeps trying to do that through the whole episode. She never gives him what he's looking for, though. It just keeps getting worse.
Well,
because she's clearly not ready to like get moved past this and be like best buddies again. He's ready to kind of be best friends again, and she is not.
That's completely just men and women. That's how I often go back to the idea that, okay, how would this show even work if it were like a male, I should say, you know, cisgendered heterosexual relationship, or female, like, no, you wouldn't have these interesting dynamics. Like you wouldn't have the same sort of dynamics, in that sort of partnership. And I think that's kind of what makes their partnership so interesting, is because they're such different people. But I think that it's the thing that makes me laugh so much is when I think it's when she's in the motel and he's calling her and he's like, "What, do you got a date?" Like, and he says it with like such scorn that you know she hangs up the phone and is like, "You know what, you motherfucker, I'm gonna go on a date."
Yeah,
you can see it in her face.
Yeah, like, you can.
And I love that. And then I love the next day when he's calling her in the morning and she's not answering, and you can kind of see this, like, the panic face is showing up, like, "Oh shit, what did I do?" Like, and I mean, even
now,
subconsciously, like, I'm not like projecting shippiness onto it, even subconsciously he's probably thinking, "Oh my God, she's out with some guy." Like, I think that he's thinking that. And I from the way he behaves at the end of the episode, it's so, like, it's like jealous Mulder without, like, being jealous Mulder, if that makes sense. You know?
No, I think he's definitely, I think there's a lot of things informing his attitude at the end. One is kind of like, it was probably unwise for you to get mixed up with a murderer, but it's also like, you know, clearly you got involved with this guy, and he's just really puzzled by all of that. He doesn't understand it. He's confused. He's mad. He's jealous. It's all of those things at the same time. But, you know, she was not going to go on that date until he said, "What are you going to do? Go on a date?"
And right.
I don't think she had any plans whatsoever.
No, I agree with you.
To go on a date with Ed until he said that.
Completely. That's why.
And you're,
I mean,
right. You can see it all on her face.
Yeah. I mean, I will always stand by that this entire thing was just in reaction to him.
Yeah.
Not
for sure.
Not reaction to cancer, not reaction to anything. It's just so clear to me that it's reaction to Mulder.
I mean, she practically comes right out and says that.
Yeah. But
it's,
I mean,
it's
at the
very
end,
clear.
But she doesn't to him, because at the end she backtracks. It's like he says, he sounds like a dick, but he's hit the nail on the head. He goes, "All this because I didn't give you a desk." And because it's like, he's still talking about the desk, but he's not wrong, because she tells him, "Not everything is about you. This is my life," which is true. But but this was about him.
Yeah, and it really was.
And that's the only way she's going to say that and that's the only way she's going to get out of this alive. You know what I mean? Like, she's not. And I wanted to ask you too, what was your interpretation of what the end of that sentence was going to be?
Oh my God. I remember this bit just being such like an explosion on the internet the night that this aired, of people speculating what was Mulder going to say. And it's honestly really troubled me over the years.
It hasn't troubled me at all.
I've always tried to figure this out.
It hasn't troubled me at all.
Let's review what the lines were. I wrote them down. So Scully says, "Not everything is about you, Mulder. This is my life." And then Mulder says, "Yes, but it's
my life too."
Well, I don't think there's any other way to interpret that. I've heard many other theories over the years.
Do you agree with me? It seems obvious.
Yeah, no, okay. I do agree.
You just said it's troubled you over the years, and it hasn't troubled me at all, because I think it's obvious.
No. Well, it's troubled me because I see lots of other interpretations, and I think maybe I'm on the wrong track.
Oh, no. I
started to question myself.
It's so clear to me that that's what he was going to say. When I hear people go, "Oh, what was he going to say? Oh, that's perfect that he said that." I go, "Well, what did you think he was going to say?" Like, I hear it in my head every single time.
Well, it seems like that's the most, you know, when you're listening to kind of the rhythm of the conversation and the way it's going, I don't see how else it could have gone, although I've heard other people suggest he was going to say something like, "Yes, but it's my work," or something like that, or I don't know.
And that's not as impactful.
Not at all.
It doesn't even make sense.
Doesn't really make sense. Not in the context, and not with the syntax he's using. Because he's clearly starting the word, something starting with an M.
It's my something.
Yes, but the question is, if we both agree that he's going to say, "Yes, but it's my life too," is he saying that her life is his life in a kind of, you know, happy shippy way?
Not in a shippy way, just in a look, we're in this together, like, whether we like it or not. I don't think that he intended that to be like, I'm not, again, you know me, I'm always looking for the romance anywhere I can, but like, I don't think that's what this is about. I think it's them both acknowledging that they've sort of crossed the line from professional into personal, And right. that they are each other's lives at this point.
Yeah. I think that's really, it's really profound. And also interesting that he doesn't say it, that he cuts himself short.
He stops himself. Because I feel like it's the same thing as like the Mulder we see in we were just talking about this, season 7 in Requiem, when he's going to tell her, he says, I don't want to risk, and he stops.
Yeah.
But he makes a different choice. He actually decides to say what he's thinking.
Yeah, I don't want to risk losing you.
Yeah, and I think it's so great that they kind of keep that very, it's such a Mulder thing for him to be, you know, he's being thoughtful, but he also is like, look, I don't want to say something that's going to be misinterpreted because you were already so pissed the other day, and I don't want, you know, and so he has to kind of, he stops himself. And doesn't finish the sentence. And I often wonder about that. Like, what does she interpret it? Like, does she hear it the same way I hear it? You know?
I mean, the look on her face is very much, she's certainly curious in what he's about to say. He grabs her attention, I think, with what he says there.
Yeah.
And I think she probably would guess that that's what he was going to say. To me, she doesn't seem like that's necessarily what she wants to hear at that moment. I'm not really sure. I waver a bit on the exact reason for why he doesn't finish his sentence, whether it's because he doesn't quite have the courage to go through with it and to put it right out there because it's such a bold statement.
Yeah.
Or is it more like he knows that he's in trouble already and he doesn't want to say anything too much at that point about himself because he doesn't want to piss Scully off anymore because all he knows is she keeps saying it's not about him. And maybe he realizes halfway through that sentence that he's about to make it about himself again.
Yeah.
I don't know which of those things stopped him, maybe both together.
Yeah, it is a bit of self-awareness on his part, if that's the case, which I oftentimes don't believe him entirely capable of.
No, I know.
Especially in these sorts of heated emotional exchanges between them. But I feel like he also, as they both do, I think anytime any sort of like emotional conversation or anything that kind of has to do with their relationship comes up or might come up, they both retreat. And that's just the way they operate. And I think that's exactly what was about to happen. And he pulled back. I think that's what happened here.
Absolutely. I think you're right, too. They came so close. Like, that's like farther than they would normally go.
Right.
And it's just so tantalizing. It's so X-Files. Mm-hmm. But I actually really do like that, the way that ended like that, that it's, you know, left very sort of unfinished.
Yeah.
And it's kind of intriguing.
Such a great character, just a very great character-driven episode. It's not, you know, it's not like a typical X-Files episode. I completely understand why they wouldn't show it after the Super Bowl. I bet a lot of people would probably be like, what is this show? This doesn't make any sense. But like, I just love it. It's like my favorite. This is my favorite kind of Scully, is when she is like, you know what? Fuck you, Mulder. That's my favorite Scully. So that's probably why I love this episode. But I wanted to talk about another huge major topic before this goes too long. But before I get into that topic, I wanted to bring up the fact that the song that plays while Ed's murdering the neighbor.
Yeah.
It's the Partridge Family.
David
Cassidy. It's called Doesn't Somebody Want to Be Wanted? And I was just like, what a perfect song. And Glenn Morgan is awesome at this, at doing this music, the music playing against the action. I mean, that's kind of like his little go-to. It's his thing. But I think that that's such a perfect song to play because it describes Scully in this episode.
It really does.
It's exactly
she just wants to be wanted.
She wants to be appreciated, acknowledged, noticed. Like they come back in Milagro, we've talked about, seems to be kind of almost like a sequel to this episode or almost like a part of it.
I agree.
And that's her character. And it's so consistent. And I think that was such a great song choice. I wanted to bring that out. Okay.
Yeah. I agree that there's definitely some parallels with Milagro, that Scully, when she's feeling a little bit taken for granted by Mulder, is mysteriously attracted to kind of weirdo, creepy guys who pay her attention because that attention is intriguing and she's intrigued by odd fellows. So
yeah. And I'm really glad that they didn't go the same route with Milagro because I would have been like, come on, Scully, twice.
Yeah, no, exactly. But it's consistent with how she behaves in these scenarios.
Absolutely, completely. Yeah, totally. Real quick, before I get into my big topic, the important topic, I wanted to shout out to Jodie Foster, who I think did a fantastic job playing the tattoo.
Oh my God, yeah. And you mentioned on our top 25 about the difference when you watch the episode with headphones on, with how her voice is produced.
Yeah.
It's a totally different experience watching the episode that way.
Right? It's
If people have not watched Never Again with headphones on, you have to. Because I watched it once without headphones this week and once with headphones. And honestly, the first time I watched it without the headphones, I was like, I don't know why I remember Jodie Foster being that good. She's not really great. But then when I watched it with the headphones on, it was like, this is so great.
Yeah, because it's like totally she's in your head. Experience.
She's literally in her head. Like, what a really smart way to produce that. And this was back in the day when everyone just watched things on TV. And so it's interesting that they did that. I don't know if that's something they added in later versions of that episode or if her voice was always produced that way.
Yeah.
Because it's really quite forward thinking. People didn't generally watch TV with headphones on back then.
Right. I'm not sure either, but I love it.
It's really cool. It really adds to the whole show. It adds a whole other layer. The sound is done in such an interesting way. And so, yeah, I've got to really give a shout out for that sound design because she literally feels like she's inside your head.
I remember
really super creepy.
The first time I was watching it, I was like, wait, what is happening? Like, I was so confused. Like, I was looking behind me because I was like, is somebody behind me? Like, playing? I didn't know what was happening. It was so bizarre, but like, it was so effective.
Right.
Really cool.
Thank God you warned me. I would have freaked out otherwise, I think, because it's freaky.
It's
freaky. Really freaky. And it's like really helps to kind of hammer home what's going on. I'm really interested in what's going on with Ed Juris in this episode as well, that it looks for the whole episode, we're kind of the theory that we're kind of led to believe is that he's just going a little cuckoo because of the tattoo and because of the substances in the tattoo. But it's intriguing to me that at the end of the episode, it turns out that no, he didn't have the levels of this substance in his blood were not high enough to have caused the kind of hallucinogenic properties.
Didn't they say that Scully didn't have enough?
I think neither of them did.
Oh, okay.
Here, I've got the script right in front of me. Let's have a little look.
Okay.
Because
I have an interesting theory on that.
I'd like to hear it. Traces of ergot were found in his bloodstream, as in yours, but not to the degree that should cause hallucinogenic ergotism.
Okay.
That's what Mulder says to Scully.
So that could have
We can't blame the tattoo in the end.
It's funny because I guess every time I hear that, I thought the way he delivers the line made me think that he was only referring to hers, but the way that you read the script makes me think he's referring to both. So,
I never realized that myself. I used to think that explained his behavior because I don't think I noticed him saying it myself that way. It was only when I listened really carefully that I realized, oh, wait a second, Ed Juris did not have anything physically wrong with him from that tattoo.
That's interesting.
Which is an intriguing angle.
I think that there was something, it's possible there was something paranormal going on, but I think more likely is it was just this sort of deep-seated misogyny coming out. And I feel like Glenn, Morgan and James Wong are men and they wrote this episode and I think they handled it so well. I mean, throughout the entire thing, they treat the character of Scully with just utter dignity, and she's doing everything that I think that like she would do in this. We may disagree on that, but in this scenario, I feel like she's doing everything she wants to do. She's making all these active choices, and I love the idea that they have that scene kind of near the end where she wakes up. She wakes up at his apartment, and the cops show up, and they're even kind of giving her the side eye, like, "Who are you, you slut?
Yeah.
Why are you here?" And you know that's what they're thinking, and she is like trying so hard to deal with that, knowing that that's what they're thinking and trying to be taken seriously in this scenario when she's like, look, you could talk to me, pretend I'm a dude. Like, it's almost like she's trying to say that to them. Why are you giving me the side eye? If I were a dude, you would be offering me everything right now. And I think I think that they dealt with that in such an interesting way and a very subtle way. Like it's not necessarily the way they're treating her is subtle, but the idea that's part of this episode where we're dealing with this antagonist who is this misogynist, maybe repressed misogyny, obviously coming off the divorce. He's got all these sorts of feelings of anger. I mean, I read recently some article statistics. I don't remember what I was reading, but about a lot of men who go and they kind of take it out on women when they're treated poorly by women. And I mean, obviously, this is probably common knowledge, but it's just, I think it's just a really interesting commentary on that, especially if that thing is true that you brought up, that it was there was nothing wrong with him. He was, it was all in his head.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting and really, I think ahead of its time in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that in today's culture, we're more aware of misogyny, and it's become very ugly in a lot of ways, a little bit more open online. There's a little bit more open misogyny than perhaps we used to see at one time.
Yeah.
And it's really like they've really nailed it, I think, about what the nature of that style of misogyny is, of blaming women for everything that's gone wrong in your life. I mean, everything that the tattoo says, I think, is what Ed's sort of subconscious really believes. This idea that women are to blame for all of his problems. You know, at one point the tattoo's talking about Scully and says that bitch would have been just like all the others.
Right.
It's exactly the kind of thing you hear from these misogynist jerks online, quite frankly.
Yeah.
And I find it really interesting. And in the end, he even blames the tattoo for his behavior. So again, he's blaming a woman, essentially. To his mind, I think that tattoo is another female.
Yeah.
So he is again blaming a female for his behavior. And I think at one point the tattoo artist or the tattoo parlor owner says something about, you know, the tattoo reflects what lies in a person's soul.
Right. And he says everybody gets the tattoo they deserve.
And everyone gets the tattoo they deserve. And so I think that that's truly how Ed felt. And I think that portraying him as, you know, on the surface, not a bad guy, kind of attractive, kind of, you know, he can be fun to hang around with. He, you know, seems like a pretty fun date. Except for, you know, when it gets a little weird. But I think it's a really interesting, a well-done character in terms of, you know, he's not a bad guy all the time, but he's got some nasty opinions underneath the surface that's driving his behavior.
And I think that's kind of the commentary they're trying to present here, is that that's how misogyny presents itself, is this these normal-seeming men that you have no idea that they have all these behaviors and these ideas and these thoughts. They all seem great on the outside, you know, and it's so deep seated to almost be to the point of unconscious, because I don't think Ed thinks he's a misogynist. I mean,
I don't think he does.
Most men probably don't.
They think they're nice guys and that the women are the problem.
Exactly.
It's women that are treating them badly. They're just these perfectly nice guys. They can't understand why women are treating them this way. And if women are going to be bitches, well, I'm going to call them bitches. I think that's the attitude.
It's an entitled attitude.
It really
is. And that's, you know, we're not going to get into a debate on misogyny when we're talking about the X-Files to this extent. But I think that's
but it's there for
what
sure.
You say about it being ahead of its time, especially like right now in the modern climate and all of the stuff that's going on right now. I think it makes me appreciate an episode like this even more, the fact that this came out in what, 97? I mean, it's impressive. It's very impressive.
It's really well done, I think, and that I think it ages really well. Not every episode of the X-Files ages well in terms of sort of our culture, but that episode ages really well with that issue and how it's dealt with. So I like that a lot.
Okay. Well, my last major big issue that we need to discuss,
okay,
because everybody's going to be waiting for it.
Yeah.
Jen, did or did not Scully sleep with Ed Gers?
She didn't. Don't believe so.
Your team no banging?
I'm team no banging.
I am. I'm team banging.
Okay. Tell me why you're team banging, and then I'll tell you why I'm team not banging, and then we'll let the listeners decide who's right.
All right. When we release this, we'll do another poll, even though I've seen this poll 82 times. Okay. Well, first of all, does your theory have anything to do with the pantyhose debate?
No.
Okay.
It doesn't.
I think we can actually like scratch that, because in one shot you see them and then one shot you don't, which is what the X-Files loves to do. So,
and honestly, I don't think we're even supposed to notice them. I don't feel like it's obvious enough to be taken as evidence. So that's why I just ignore them.
And I say it's a non-issue too. And I have to bring this up though, because this is what the first thing people jump to. I have to bring this up. It doesn't even necessarily mean she's wearing pantyhose. She could be wearing stockings that don't go up. So it doesn't mean anything. So tell me your reasoning.
For why I'm team non-banging?
Yeah.
I'm just taking it on the simplest level without trying to think too hard. And I think that, first of all, I think that the creators are giving very mixed messages, which is why we are having this debate right now. Because I think everything that leads up to the ad break makes it seem very obvious that they're about to have sex. Like, in very clear television terms, they're canoodling, to use the technical term, the camera pulls back, the door closes. I mean, I don't know what we're supposed to think at that moment other than sex will ensue. But then after the ad break, there's a different story presented. And this is why I'm on team no banging. He's waking up on the couch. He still has his clothes on. He's still wearing jeans. She's not as dressed as he is and appears to be wearing his shirt, which is a little weird for my scenario. Mm-hmm. But I think that the guy being on the couch with his jeans on is television shorthand for they didn't have sex. And so that's why I'm on team non-banging.
I think that a great deal of this has to do with what you kind of want, what you want to be true.
Probably.
No, I don't want Scully to have slept with the psychotic killer. But, you know, come on. Like, the woman is deprived. You know what I mean? Let her go get hers.
I know. I'd be fine with it.
And I think this is my, and again, I don't want to bring up the pantyhose thing again because I don't think that that holds any weight. I think you could really, really take it either way. And I think that's kind of what, I think they do that on purpose. Like, I think that the only evidence that I think is really, really in your favor, besides common TV language, which I don't think the X-Files follows those rules, but that's another conversation for another day, is that it's, I think Chris Carter is a bit of a Puritan, should I say? Yeah. And he's made it very clear that Scully is not a sexual person. I'm not a fan of that interpretation. And so in my mind, I think that this, and Glenn Morgan and Gillian Anderson were both team banging. Let me just put it out
there.
They
were. Yeah. For sure.
They said, let her have this. This is part of the story. This is something that should happen. And I think the story feels incomplete without it, from a storytelling perspective. Yeah. It seems unnecessary as to watch a show with, I don't know. It's just the only reason we're even having this debate is because it's so out of the ordinary to see either of them in this sort of scenario, you know?
It is.
And so it's like we have to kind of guess their motivations. And I mean, everything that I've seen leading up to this, especially the things that I was talking about earlier about how she reacted when he kind of like grabbed her, was like, this isn't just, let's have a kiss goodnight and go sleep. This is like throwdown behavior that I'm witnessing.
For sure. It was sexy hotness for sure.
Yeah. So I just am like, it doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't, you know, have some fun on the floor or something happened very quickly or maybe something happened that wasn't quite, you know, a home run, but maybe they got a certain amount of bases. I'm trying to keep this clean for the non-explicit folks. But, it doesn't necessarily mean that that didn't happen. And then he said, why don't you take the bed? Or she awkwardly, you know, he got up or something. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of different scenarios that could have happened.
Oh, sure.
I don't know. I think the jury is still out, but I would love to put out another poll when we release this episode and see what people think. We're going to do team banging and team no banging.
I love it.
Those sound like shirts and we need to make them. And I love it.
I think we do. I'm not like steadfastly on team non-banging. I think there was no banging, but if I can be convinced otherwise, I would be thrilled for Scully because she definitely deserves it. I'm definitely like, I'm pro banging. Yeah. I'm just, you know, I'm not seeing it, sadly.
You're weighing the evidence. And I actually really appreciate that because in general, I like to do that on this show. I like to look at what I see and make my interpretations based on that. And, you know, somebody on Twitter the other day actually made a really good point, and I wish I remembered who it was, but they said, you know, they didn't sleep together because if they did, Scully would have been out of that room in the middle of the night. And I was like, you know what? That's the way to get me to come to your side.
That's actually a really good point.
That's a really good point.
We know that's what she does. So,
right.
The fact that she would have just sort of hung around there so super, super comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually
she didn't look super comfortable when she woke up. Let me tell you. She was
a little bit like, what am I doing?
She looked like what just happened? This is not me. But then when the cops arrive, she seems kind of a little more natural.
Pretty quick. She's flashing the FBI badge around and everything. She gets it together.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and she does sleep. I don't know. She does sleep fully clothed. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's,
I guess
it's
I just
left. You know, it's ambiguous as everything on the X-Files is, so that, you know, all these years later, we can have this conversation.
I don't necessarily have all of the evidence to back this up. I will admit that. But the reason I'm on Team Bangin' is out of pure desire.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay. I want it to have happened. So that's the team
on. And I agree that the way the story is structured, it makes the most sense that I have a feeling, from what I understand, there was intended to be a more clearly sort of sexual scene that we were all going to be on Team Bangin'.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's how it was exactly written. I don't know what the original script was, but you're right. I mean, I think that at least Glenn Morgan's on record basically saying he wanted it to be a Bangin' kind of episode.
And Jillian
did too.
And I'm not quite sure at what point
that was decided. I don't know if they got as far as, you know, the filming before it was decided, or at what point that was.
Well, this scene was never filmed. I think that it was in the script, and I wish it was filmed because I would love to find it and watch it.
Oh, but, we would already have seen it by now.
Yeah, but I believe that they both agreed on it. It was in the script, and Chris Carter nixed it. He said, we're not doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
Which doesn't necessarily mean that it didn't happen. It just means we didn't get that scene. So
no, absolutely. I mean, I think that if you're on Team Bangin', you've got some good points to make as well. So, you know, I there's some things on the X-Files that I'm pretty adamant about. This is not necessarily one of them, but I think that it's just, to me, on balance, Team Non-Bangin' is where I am.
Okay.
So.
If I had to choose,
let's hear.
If I had to choose like a handful of hills to die upon, this wouldn't be there.
Okay.
This wouldn't be on that handful.
Yeah, no, I don't think it would be either for me. But it's just, that's just, but you know, I have an opinion about everything, and that's my opinion about this.
Yeah, it's a fun topic.
It is. I was surprised how many people were on Team Bangin', actually. I only have recently come to understand that so many people are on Team Bangin'. And when I read the reasoning and hear yours, I kind of get it now. It's kind of like, oh, okay. I didn't realize we could see it that way, but I'm good with that.
I just love that we keep saying Team Bangin', and I just love it.
I'm just having fun saying that at this point. So I'm just looking for any excuse to say it right now.
Exactly. Do you have anything else to say about Never Again?
I don't, except that I would not say that Never Again describes the number of times I'm going to watch that episode, because I probably will watch it again, and maybe sooner rather than later, because our conversation has further enlightened me about
the episode.
So I appreciate that.
That's what we're here for. I mean, the fact that you said earlier that you liked it more, even a little more than what you remember, to me, I'll take that as a positive. So,
oh yeah, for sure.
Yes. Well, then now, Jen, you need to think of an episode for me to watch that maybe I'm not a huge fan of, and then we should have a discussion. So we'll
do that.
That'll be a fun another discussion. If there's an episode that you guys want to hear us talk about, let us know, because we are open to suggestions, a topic, a list, an episode, anything you want to hear. Please just shout out to us at XFD Podcast on Twitter. Please leave us a review and a rating, all that good stuff on iTunes. That helps all the MSR lovers find us. We want people to find our podcast because we are quite niche, and I like that about us.
We are niche.
And I have to actually throw out a formal apology, because I can hear him right now. My cat, Mulder, he cried throughout the entire episode last time. And I am so sorry about that. I need to lock him up. But if I lock him up, he'll just cry more.
No,
so
that's okay.
I know.
I don't mind.
As long as
Speaking for myself, I don't mind.
His name is Mulder, so it's okay. I guess it slides.
It's okay. Exactly. There's an X-Files connection. I find him charming. I love Mulder. I love cats, and I can't have one because of allergies. So I feel like Mulder can be kind of like my long distance cat.
Okay, good.
By virtue of hearing his voice. So I'm good with it.
For all the people
we should put a, we could do a poll about this or something, maybe see what the listeners think about Mulder. Let us know what you think of Mulder the cat.
I don't want anyone to say any bad things about Mulder the cat.
No, so they're only allowed to say good things.
Let's not put that out to the listeners. But if you have positive things to say about Mulder the cat, please let me know.
We should tweet a picture of him again. You tweet pictures of him on a regular basis, but I don't think we have actually tweeted a picture of him on the podcast.
We will
Twitter
do that
feed, so I think we're gonna have to, because I believe he's a co-host now.
He's technically is, because he's on the podcast more than me. Anyway, well, thanks you guys for listening, and we will be back with you in 2 weeks for another installment of The X-Files Diaries.
Bye!
Thank you.